True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
Hi, I'm Dick.
Larry McNabney lived an exciting and tumultuous life. Haunted by tragedies in his early life, Larry drank to excess and he did his fair share of pharmaceuticals. But Larry's biggest passions were love and money. He loved and lost again and again with five marriages and countless relationships. As a talented and hardworking attorney, he earned millions of dollars. But Larry could spend money just as quickly as he earned it. He enjoyed an extravagant lifestyle, and he took pleasure in sharing his fortunes with the ones that he loved. Now, with all the risks that Larry took in his life, it was the risk that he took in marrying his fifth wife, Elisa McNabney, that did him in. Elisa was attractive, intelligent, a young woman with a very checkered past. She was born under a different name, a high school dropout with a lengthy criminal record. She took everything Larry had, including his life. In Risky Business, The Murder of Larry McNabney, we follow the winding trail of two complicated lives that intersected with catastrophic results, leaving them both dead in the end.
So you probably want a beer.
I think we'll need a beer, of course.
Okay. Yeah, this is a tough case. So I picked a beer from California because that's where the crime occurred. I mean, they were back and forth between California and Nevada.
Right, right.
But I did a California beer. And I did one that's a world-famous beer. It's called Duck Duck Goose by the Lost Abbey in San Marcos, California. Now, Duck Duck Goose is a Goose beer. So these are blends of old and young lambics, which are then aged 2 to 3 years after bottling. So a lambic is a beer that is just sitting out there to be spontaneously fermented. So a Guza is a lambic, a blend of young ones and old ones combined together, then bottled for 2 to 3 years. They tend to be drier and fruitier than typical lambics, and they are more intensely sour. And this one's no exception. So Duck Duck Goose, just put out about every 3 years by Lost Abbey, is a straw yellow color with no head, because these beers tend to not be very carbonated at all. It's a very tart lemon aroma with a little bit of peach, and the taste follows the nose precisely. Really tart lemon, and maybe a little bit of peach, I'm not sure, but the lemon predominates. That's definite.
Sounds really delicious. I'm looking forward to trying it.
It is delicious, and it really puckers up your salivary glands.
I love the sours.
This is a good one. I know you're going to like it, so let's open it up and take it down.
Sure. It's a good break from the stouts for me.
It's for you, baby.
All right. Let's open it up. Okay. Let's head down to the quiet end.
Yeah, it's still pretty quiet.
Yeah, well, we had some warm weather, and now we got snow last night, so we're back to winter again.
Yeah, I know. But it's supposed to warm up again. But yeah, that was kind of a sneak attack of snow, so people are probably still digging out and getting things cleared out.
I think that's the greater being's way of telling us that we need to move somewhere warm.
Okay.
It's a message.
There's the message there.
From the beyond, yes.
A sneak attack of snow.
Yes.
So Larry McNabney went missing on 9/11/2001. And this is a day that's infamous because it's now known simply as 9/11, the day the Twin Towers went down. Thousands of people were killed in New York. But this is when Larry went missing, same day. So their horse trainer, Greg Whalen, was up early to feed the horses. He was staying in the same hotel as Elisa and Larry. They were at a horse show in the City of Industry, which is about 40 minutes outside of Los Angeles. Greg saw Elisa just around 5 in the morning. She was out walking her dog. Now, Elisa is an attractive woman, and she was pretty much aware of her attractiveness.
I think she used it well.
She did. She was tall, dark, and sexy, and always drew attention to herself. So she approached 72-year-old Greg and told him that Larry had just up and left the night before. They'd had an argument. Larry told her he was done showing horses and he was going back to join a cult.
Yeah, so she was referring to a cult, I guess you'd call it, someplace where he was before, earlier in his life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, even before Elisa.
Yes, exactly.
But we'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll go over that.
So this is kind of strange news to Greg, but as he thought things over the past few days of the trip, he realized that something had been going on with Larry. Greg and his daughter had driven down for the Pacific Quarter Horse Classic on September 5th. One of Larry's horses, Just a Lot of Page, was worth at least $30,000, with the potential to be sold to a breeder for much more. Since Larry had bought Just a Lot of Page, he hadn't practiced the law much, even though he owned a successful personal injury practice. But Larry instead had been traveling the country with his horse, hoping to cash in for a big profit. So he was trying for a Rookie of the Year thing, for showing the horse.
Yeah.
And then if the horse looked good enough, people would bid on it and he'd make bucks.
Yeah, and it seems like he was really getting into this at that point in his life.
Yeah, it seems like the law was in the background.
Yeah, well, he'd like had enough of that.
He is moving on.
Yeah. Greg remembered that Larry'd been acting strangely all weekend, though. He'd been drinking a lot, which was normal, actually. But usually the alcohol made him more talkative and bubbly and fun. That weekend, Larry was very withdrawn and sad. He'd wanted to stay in his hotel room by himself quite a lot. His appearance had been off, too. He was usually clean and well put together, but he looked kind of sloppy. He kind of had that Steve Bannon look going on.
Yeah, yeah, kind of slovenly.
Yeah. So during the horse showing, he appeared to be kind of confused, too, by what he was doing. Greg's daughter, Debbie, thought he seemed more depressed than usual. On Sunday night at dinner, there'd been a little bit of a scene.
A little bit.
A little bit.
Right.
Everyone had gone out to dinner, so Greg and his daughter, Debbie, Larry and Elisa, and Elisa's young secretary, Sarah Dutra. Larry's drinking was worse than ever that night. He was at the point of slurring his words. And he seemed very angry with Sarah. He was glaring at her and making mad faces. And at one point, he called her a bitch right in front of everybody. Now, Elisa had been spending quite a bit of her time with Sarah. The two of them were staying away from Larry, too. On either a Friday or Saturday, Debbie overheard Elisa talking about making sure that Larry had enough to drink so that he would pass out. Then she and Sarah could go out and party together. So Elisa's like in her 30s now, but she's kind of having this second teenagehood going on with the 21, 22-year-old Sarah.
Sarah's a college student.
Yeah. At Sunday's dinner, there was noticeable tension between Larry and Sarah. Sarah's a pretty 21-year-old student, and she always seemed to be with Elisa. Larry actually seemed jealous of her relationship with his wife. The two seemed like more than just friends. At one point, Sarah gave him the finger, and she said, "Fuck you, Larry." Gary had to help walk Larry out of the restaurant. He was so unsteady.
Yeah, he was kind of crushed.
Yes. Now, Larry told Greg months ago that he thought Elisa and Sarah were too close, so this seemed to be an issue.
Yeah, the next day, Monday, Larry seemed preoccupied and withdrawn. But at the same time, he was enthusiastic about the future, and he talked with Greg about future horse shows. They're planning on traveling not just to the West Coast, but throughout the country.
Yeah, they've got big plans. Shows.
They got plans. So Monday night, he declined Greg's invitation to come out to dinner and chose to stay in his hotel room. Elisa came to dinner and picked up food and wine to bring back to Larry, who was staying in the room. Then the next morning, Tuesday, 9/11, he wasn't there anymore. Let's go over the backgrounds of Larry and Elisa before we get to how they became involved with each other.
That's a good idea. Larry's father, Mac McNabney, he was in the military and served in World War II. He married Marie Williams in 1943. Larry's brother Jimmy was born in 1947, and Larry was born just a little over a year after that. They lived in Reno, Nevada. While both the boys were still toddlers, Mac was called back to service in the Korean War. According to those that knew him best, Mac was changed after that war. He medicated himself by drinking. His alcoholism took over his life, as it tends to do. In public, Mac was fun and he was the life of the party, but at home, he could be a real monster. He was strict, demanding, and impossible to please. So, from the outside, the McNabney family looked okay. Mac managed the University of Nevada bookstore. His family lived in a nice home. They had two cars, and they were members of the local country club. Jimmy and Larry went to public school. Their father demanded academic and athletic accomplishment from them, and they didn't disappoint him. They both got good grades and played in sports. Larry met the girl who would become his first wife in his senior year of high school. Donna Pagini went to another high school on the other side of town, and she had a very different family from the McNabneys. They were a big, loud, rambunctious, loving family, and this attracted Larry, as you can imagine. They dated through senior year and became engaged before they graduated. Larry's mother thought Larry chose Donna as a way to rebel against his father, who didn't approve of her family at all. Donna's father didn't approve of Larry either. Larry was uptight and cold in his eyes. He came across as conceited and even rude. Now, Donna, on the other hand, was terrified of Larry's father.
Boy, this is a good start, huh?
It's really a lot going on.
They don't like each other's families.
No.
That's a tough one.
But, you know, when you're 17 or 18, that can be the most attractive thing about a person, is that your parents hate them.
Yeah, that's true. But, boy, that's a tough way to start a relationship.
Yes, sure is. Now, Larry went to the University of Nevada in Reno and majored in business. In a year, Donna and Larry were married. In 1968, Donna gave birth to their daughter, Kristen, but the marriage wasn't going well. Larry seemed uncomfortable with her big family, and he began to drink more and more. He drank too much, and he became belligerent and mean. He was condescending with her, and he began insulting her. Larry graduated from college in 1970. He was accepted as a student at the McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento, California. So this should have been a really happy time.
Should have been, right?
Yeah. Larry and Donna moved to Sacramento, but Donna hated it there, and they just weren't happy together. Donna, who came from this close family, missed them. She left Larry and moved back to Reno with their daughter, and she filed for divorce. The paper trail on Larry kind of goes blank here for a few years. Most people who knew him then said that Larry didn't actually enroll in the law school then, but he joined the Army. And as we know, the Vietnam War was going on at this time. But Larry was lucky enough to just serve in Fort Benning in Georgia. And this was a requirement of him from his ROTC reserve membership that he joined in college.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a person who grew up in the same era,
yep.
Larry was a lucky guy.
Yes, and I'm sure it helped that he had the college education.
Well, didn't matter. If you had the right number, you were going to NAM. So
yeah,
he got lucky.
Yes, he sure did.
So Larry's brother, Jimmy, had been in the Navy for 2 years. He got married in 1970. The mother, Marie, finally had it with Mac. She'd been married to him for 27 years, but his drinking had gotten progressively worse, particularly over the past 10 years. So Marie left Mac and filed for divorce. So Marie got the house, half of Mac's substantial portfolio, and alimony. Mac's response to all this was to shoot and kill himself. And then even more shockingly, 3 weeks later, Larry's brother Jimmy killed himself with an intentional drug overdose. So that's a lot of trauma.
Yeah, how this affected Larry is really hard for anyone to imagine. These self-inflicted deaths of two of his close family members, that would never leave his psyche for his whole life.
No, it wouldn't. More than one time, Larry contemplated suicide himself.
And Marie, she's dealing with a lot of guilt and pain. So Larry's kind of on his own to deal with this.
Yeah, he felt like he was abandoned by his family. Now, they had never been a close, demonstrative group, but whatever intimacy he had in the original family dynamics was lost now. And then his sadness about all this tended to make him very self-destructive.
Well, yeah, and he's just gone through a divorce and had his daughter taken away as well.
Yeah. But he still is a romantic at heart. He never gave up on love.
He never did. In 1973, Larry married Jody Cotton, love that name, a young divorced woman with a 5-year-old daughter, Tavia. Kristen was 5, and she attended the ceremony. Larry adopted Tavia, and Kristen was really excited to be getting a sister. Larry was now in law school at McGeorge. His mother was supporting him financially through school, so things were going okay with that, and he graduated in 1974 at the top of his class. Of course, because Larry never did anything half-ass.
No, he's going to be the best.
That's right.
So he's preparing for the bar exam, and as he's doing this, he gets appointed to a clerkship. After he passed the bar, he joined the Washoe County Public Defender's Office as a juvenile deputy. Then he did that for a few years, and in 1977, he left the Public Defender's Office to become a partner with Reno lawyer Ron J. Bath. Bath had also been a public defender. He is conservative and disciplined with money, which is pretty much the opposite of Larry, who loved to spend money and have fun.
Yeah, Larry had a likable personality, plus he was a very talented trial attorney. Now, he did have this drinking problem, but he was never known to come to court drunk. It didn't seem to affect his job, at least in that kind of direct way. I'm sure it affected it in some ways. But in 1979, the two men bought a Reno mansion, and they actually converted this mansion to an office building, which really impresses me, because they did the work themselves, tearing down walls, painting late at night, and getting up the next day to go to court. So this is something only young men would do.
That's for sure.
It sounds so exhausting. Bath was really handy and was good at that kind of stuff, and Larry was the artistic one. So he was great for picking out the colors and the wallpaper and designing the offices.
So he had that feng shui approach.
He certainly did. The town didn't have a lot of lawyers back then, which is different from today. Larry and Bath were good trial lawyers, so they had plenty of clients. Some of the older guys didn't like to go to court. They just wanted to settle everything, but these were young upstarts, and they were anxious to go to court. So they soon became the most prominent members of the Reno Defense Bar, and they handled almost exclusively criminal cases. They handled drug cases, cases where their clients were accused of cheating casinos, and about half a dozen murder cases per year. They were super busy.
Yeah, they had a good practice going.
They did. They were on a roll.
So in 1982, Jody and Larry divorced. It's a pretty bitter divorce, and the result of which was Larry's drinking increased. But by the winter of 1983, so a little over a year, Larry fell deeply in love again. This woman's name was Gail June Fredericks, who worked as a Social Security administrator. They married just a few months into their relationship, and Gail moved into Larry's house with him.
About 1 month after the wedding, a man in Reno was arrested and charged with molesting up to 50 children at a nursery school that was operated by his mother. Larry and a friend of his named Tom Brennan agreed to represent some of the families who were suing the school and the school's insurance carrier. This was really a great position for them to be in because the insurance company had written an unlimited liability policy for the school, which meant a lot of money.
Lawyers are licking their chops at this one.
Absolutely. So Larry went ahead and ended his partnership with Ron Bath and decided to just go all in on that.
Right, but it wasn't just this one case. They had been growing apart, like Larry had in his relationships with women. And they just had different views on how they wanted to approach the law.
Yeah, it seemed like Larry just got bored and moved on with things, marriages, jobs, everything.
Right. So by May of 1984, the insurer for the school had settled with the families and the lawyers. Larry began to draw a $3,700 a month annuity that would grow each month and last until 2004. So this is pretty good, huh?
That's the jackpot.
20 years?
Yeah.
And you're getting $3,700 and up?
Yeah.
Each month for that whole time?
Right.
So Larry, at this point, had to be considered wealthy and successful.
Yeah, he's really gotten to a place many people would envy.
Yeah, but Larry was still his own worst enemy.
He always was. Let's talk about Elisa.
Yes. Elisa McNabney had been born Laren Renee Sims in Attleboro, Massachusetts, to Jesse and Jackie Sims. She was one of four children, and she was a smart, energetic, popular child. Father was attending MIT back in the 60s. Then in the 70s, the town of Brookville, Florida, was booming. Laren's father, Jesse, began a manufacturing business there with his two brothers and moved the family to Florida. Now, this business grew exponentially, and it became one of the town's largest employers. So as a result of this, the Sims brothers and their families became socially and politically prominent members of the community. Jesse Sims and his family settled into a very comfortable life in the country outside town, where they had room to keep horses.
So Laren really seemed destined to live a good life until she got involved with a rough crowd in high school, I guess, where things went downhill. She began hanging out with boys near the local bowling alley and drinking beer. She started spending her weekends with a wild crowd. And this change was kind of abrupt. Now, if you look at her sophomore yearbook photo, she looks like this fresh-faced young girl. But then if you look at her junior year photo, she looks like a totally different person. Her face is confident. I wouldn't say hardened because she's so young, but it's almost defiant. But it's almost defiant.
Yeah, it almost has that fuck you appearance.
A bit, yes. Laren was a senior in 1984. She dropped out to marry Virgil Scott Jordan, who was from the Northern Panhandle region of Florida. She met Virgil at a dance in the spring of 1984. He was in the military. The wedding was held at the Sims home. In January, Laren gave birth to her daughter, Haley. Not long after that, Laren and Virgil broke up, though. Laren returned home with her daughter, and soon she began a relationship with a new guy, and soon she was pregnant again. In 1986, she gave birth to a son. But in 1987, that relationship ended as well. Laren went to court to get child support, and she succeeded in getting that. Then she got her GED, and she even enrolled in college. She got a degree and a certificate as a dental technician. But she wasn't on the straight and narrow for very long. Petty crimes just dug her deeper and deeper into trouble with the law. Time after time, she received probation and racked up probation violations. It's almost like she couldn't help herself. She was willful and stubborn, and most of the trouble she found herself in stemmed from these silly little petty thefts related to disputes with friends or with boyfriends. So there seemed to be some underlying mental illness behind this behavior.
Yeah, she was stealing to get back at people that she had been in an emotional relationship with, or to impress new lovers. I mean, there's no rational reason for doing this stuff. And one of her first arrests was for stealing a $5 box of hair color. I mean, that's just basically shoplifting.
Yeah, I mean, there's a mental aspect to this. I mean, it's like Winona Ryder, when she did her thefts, she was a wealthy woman stealing makeup and nail polish and
right.
stuff.
Yes.
So there's definitely something wrong.
There certainly is.
Psychologically.
Now, she got probation for this hair color theft. Then she stole a telephone from a neighbor she was fighting with. Again, she got probation. Then she went into the house of her boyfriend's ex-wife, took an answering machine, jewelry, clothing, and an all-terrain vehicle. She said she did this to make the boyfriend happy. He had been banned from the house, and Laren had gone to get the things for him. So this behavior would become a pattern for her, as she broke the law to please her lovers and broke the law to extract revenge on her enemies.
Yeah. In January 1989, a sheriff's deputy went to arrest Laren for thefts, but she actually took off. Then she was found in Tampa and taken to jail in Brookville. She denied stealing anything but admitted to the possession of stolen goods. The arresting detectives found that two other police agencies in St. Petersburg and Winter Haven had holds on Laren for other cases they were investigating. They believed that Laren was fencing stolen property at various pawn shops in other cities. Now she was held on $5,000 bail. Initially, her parents had subscribed to the tough love technique, and they were letting her sit in jail to learn her lesson. But then they finally reconsidered, and they got her an attorney. Laren agreed to plead guilty to two burglaries, one grand theft for the vehicle, and to dealing with stolen property. She was able to avoid a jail sentence by agreeing to pay her victims $1,184, and then she got another 5 years of probation. At this point, the state attorney requested that Laren get counseling. Laren was already in counseling at the recommendation of her attorney, though. The judge ordered that she undergo a mental health evaluation, but Laren's attorney objected, and the judge agreed to forego the evaluation, as long as she continued in counseling.
Which she agreed to do, but just a few months later, she'd stopped going to the counselor. She was broke and began writing bad checks to buy necessities. So to deal with feeling depressed, she went on shopping sprees for new clothes. So in a single 6-week period, she wrote 18 bad checks. Each and every one of these checks was a violation of her probation. She couldn't pay her rent and got evicted from her mobile home. And then after she left, the landlady complained that she had stolen $1,300 in furnishings and fixtures.
Yeah.
So it looks like she's really learned from her experience so far.
No, she doesn't seem to. And that's why I say, I mean, there had to be some mental illness.
Oh, I think so.
She found a new place to live, but then she didn't check in with the probation officer like she was supposed to. She was found easily by police and arrested again and put in jail. Laren's description on her booking sheet was a 23-year-old woman. She was 5'9", 132 pounds, with a scar on her upper lip. At this point, she's a divorced, unemployed dental technician. Each bad check was a separate misdemeanor with a bond out amount of $150. A month later, her probation officer filed a warrant for her arrest. This was on charges of violating her probation. Before she could be picked up again, Laren decided to get out of town.
That's probably a good idea.
Somehow she managed to work as a dental technician for a Tampa area dentist for several months. But then she was arrested again, and when she was finally rearrested, she was finally given a 3-year prison term. So we think she's finally going to be locked up for a while. Maybe she'll learn her lesson.
Possibly. But only 3 months into this term, Laren was released because she was providing information to detectives as an informant. So this was an incredible piece of luck for Laren. And most people would be on their best behavior after being released. You know, you're looking at a 3-year term, you get out 3 months. It's like a gift from heaven. But it apparently didn't affect her that much.
No, didn't work with her. Not long after her release, she committed a new crime. Now she committed credit card fraud. Laren had befriended a Tampa police officer in a bar and went home with him. While he was sleeping, she stole from him. She took his credit cards and charged over $1,000. So she was arrested yet again, and this time she was sent to the Jefferson Correctional Institution in Monticello, Florida.
And so by 1991, a Hernando County judge tried to sort out all of Laren's violations and conflicting probation terms, because there's an untold number of these things.
Yeah, and they're piling up.
They are. So in March 92, she was allowed to go on work release, and she maintained this situation for nearly a year. But by 1993, she was again in jail for violating her probation by failing to make restitution payments and also not keeping in touch with her probation officer, which has been a pattern with her.
Absolutely. Laren had an excellent attorney this time working on her behalf, and she was allowed to stay out of prison as long as she kept a job and agreed to wear an electronic ankle monitor. So she got a job in Tampa. 3 weeks later, she gave up legal custody of her son, a 6-year-old, to his father. But she was allowed to retain custody of her daughter, Haley. But it was only 3 weeks later that Laren used her boss's credit card to take Haley out to dinner and buy some items at a discount store. The total charge was $180. So she was arrested and charged with credit card fraud. Faced with prison, she cut off her ankle monitor and disappeared with her 8-year-old daughter. What kind of sense does that make, to go out to dinner and use her boss's credit card? She knew that it was going to end up...
No kidding. I mean, she's got this track record of several years. She knows what the outcome's going to be.
It must have been so frustrating for her parents.
Can't you think that?
Yes. So she took off with Haley, who's 8, and there's some evidence that they were in South Pasadena, Florida. They'd done a credit check that showed that a Laren Sims Jordan with Laren's Social Security number was living there in 1993. But by the time police found that information, Laren was already in Las Vegas. There she was living under the name Elizabeth Ann Barash, and this was the real name of someone Laren had met in jail. In Vegas, she married a businessman named Kenneth L. Rettelsberger. From that time forward, she would be known as Elisa, which was short for Elizabeth.
Yeah, so in the mid-1980s, as Laren began her criminal career, Larry McNabney was a rich lawyer, but terribly unhappy. So it wasn't only alcohol he was abusing, it was cocaine, and according to some who were with him at the time, also heroin. Now, after the sudden deaths of his father and brother, Larry was an extremely lonely guy, who liked to use substances to numb himself. Given enough chemicals, he could be the life of the party. Now, by 1986, he divorced his third wife and got married for the fourth time shortly after. And by 1988, not an appreciably long time.
No.
That marriage was going bad.
Pretty quick.
So Larry became suicidal, and friends checked him into a substance abuse program facility near Reno. After he got sober, Larry decided he was sick of the law and sick of Reno. And besides that, he had a new love interest, a hairdresser who was a divorcee. Larry had enough money that he didn't need to work anymore, so he and his girlfriend moved to the small town of Yelm, Washington. This is where he became involved in what Elisa would call the cult.
So the cult, it was actually Ramtha's School of Enlightenment. A woman named J.Z. Knight claimed to be the channel for a 35,000-year-old ascended master named Ramtha. She was sharing her wisdom with the world.
I'm sure she was, probably for a price.
Maybe there might have been some money changing hands, but I'm sure that was secondary.
Absolutely.
Now, at the school, Larry practiced breathing exercises. He had visualizations, meditations, and this was called the synthesis of science and spirituality. He began to work as a Finnish carpenter for a local contractor, so he had no stress, and he was probably the happiest he'd ever been. So even though this was a weird thing, it kind of kept him on track, at least for a while.
For a time.
Kept him out of trouble. But, you know, Larry, he was easily bored, and he soon lost interest in the whole thing. Then his mom died in 1991. He'd never liked his mother's new husband, and then he began suggesting that he thought maybe her husband had murdered her. There was no investigation into his mother's death, but that's not unusual because she was under physician's care for a serious illness, and what that illness is, I don't know. But a legal battle did ensue between Larry and his mother's widower. So Larry returned to Reno and decided to get back into the law. This time, he wanted to be Nevada's biggest personal injury attorney. By 1993, Larry was making money and becoming locally famous. He had a large volume business that brought in injured parties through advertising. He spent a lot of money to make his name well known. And he was living with his latest girlfriend and her two daughters in Reno. And she seemed to be a pretty stable person, kind of a stabilizing force with him for a while. Don't you think?
I think so. We don't read that much about the marriage, but it seemed like
It wasn't a marriage. It was a girlfriend.
Well, girlfriend. Relationship.
Yeah.
But it seemed like he had settled down for a bit.
The business began booming, and he bought a $600,000 house. And that was in West Reno, the Coughlin Ranch area.
Right. And this is in the early to mid-90s. So a $600,000 home was pretty huge.
A mansion, right? Pretty much. He found qualified people to work for him so that he could golf a lot. And then he'd just drop into his office a couple of times a week. His commercials featured Larry, and he was wearing jeans, casual clothes, and he was standing outdoors, looking handsome and rugged and trustworthy. He would say, "I'm Larry McNabney. Trust me." That was his tagline.
Trust me, I'm a lawyer.
Yeah.
That's kind of an oxymoron.
Maybe. It's supposed to be, "Trust me, I'm a doctor." But
yeah, no, that's much better.
Well, you like that one better? In June 1995, when Larry met Elisa, she was 29 years old, and she was a fugitive from Florida.
Yeah, although nobody knows that.
No, I don't know how much he found out about her past. That's something we're not sure of, but I think he did figure out some of it.
Eventually.
Yeah. But he opened an office in Las Vegas, and he rented a nice apartment there. Then he leased an airplane to take him back and forth between Reno and Vegas. So he's really very successful at this point.
Yeah, but he needs staff.
Yeah. So to recruit staff for his new office, he put help wanted ads in the Vegas papers. And one job that he needed to fill was office manager. Elizabeth Rettelsberger applied for that job. It was 9 months after Elisa had divorced Kenneth Rettelsberger. Haley was off living with friends or her grandmother or with Kenneth. We're not sure at that time. There are no records where Elisa and Haley were for the months between her divorce from Kenneth and her arrival in Vegas either.
No, but as has happened before with Elisa, Larry was immediately smitten with her. He hired her as the office manager, even though she had little to no experience running an office. But Larry loved how smart and energetic she was. She quickly learned the personal injury business. Now, she had a killer instinct. She seemed to know instinctually how much a case was worth and how much she could get from the insurance companies. So she's born for this stuff.
He also really liked that she wasn't afraid to take a risk. That's like he was.
Right.
He'd finally met someone who he felt was like him, was like his match. She was dramatic, ruthless, with this dry, fatalistic sense of humor that he could really relate to. She excited him, even though he sensed that she was dangerous. It was only a matter of days before Lisa moved in with him at his rented space in Las Vegas, his apartment, and he soon leased some matching his and hers Jaguars for them to drive around in. He took her around town, showing her off to his friends, telling them that Elisa was one of the smartest people he'd ever met. So he was clearly taken with her. But he still had his longtime girlfriend living in his house in Reno with her daughters. Now that breakup must have been a real shit show. I can't even imagine.
No kidding.
That was a very domesticated situation. She'd moved her kids in and everything.
Right.
And then he turns up with this crazy young woman?
Well, we don't know at that point that she's crazy.
I think most people knew right away that she was a little bit...
Well, yeah. I mean, you just had to be with her for a little while and figure out that there wasn't something that was quite right.
Right. Yeah, she was at least dishonest. For Elisa, her relationship with Larry really moved her up a long way from her days in Florida. She was up in the higher classes. She introduced herself to several of Larry's acquaintances as the daughter of a wealthy Cuban businessman. She was able to pull this off as she looked a bit Hispanic, but, you know, she would give herself away because she wasn't fluent in Spanish.
I mean, why claim to be the daughter of a Cuban businessman if you can't speak Spanish? That's kind of a...
Well, the thing is, I don't think she ever thought ahead.
Right.
Right? She just did what she did for the minute, and that was it.
Yeah, I guess so. So the bookkeeper in the Las Vegas office quit. This was for other reasons, apparently. But Elisa took over the management of Larry's accounts. This included paying the bills and issuing checks. Now, within months, she took over the money management for all three of Larry's offices. Larry made her chief operating officer of Larry McNabney and Associates. And by doing this, Elisa had authority over Larry's general account, his client trust account, and even his personal accounts.
So that's pretty scary, if you know anything about her.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all financial statements and account information were set up to run through the Las Vegas office and went directly to Elisa. So this included all bills, bank statements, and any other financial documents. This included the rubber stamp of Larry's signature. Uh-oh.
Uh-oh is for sure.
Now, whether he knew it or not, Larry had put a convicted thief in charge of all of his money, and even the money of the people he was representing.
That's right. Tough situation for Larry.
But he seems kind of oblivious to it.
Well, I guess he doesn't care, because he's not that invested in the law anymore, and as long as there's money still coming in, he's happy.
I guess. I mean, but he doesn't want to get in trouble. I don't think he knew how bad things could get. Elisa didn't waste any time taking over the Reno office. She was ruthless and cold, according to Larry's employees there. Now, she was the boss of all three offices, essentially, and if you pissed her off, you were finished at the firm. From the start, she was juggling the books and embezzling money. We don't know how much Larry knew about any of this. In 1995, Elisa hired a law school graduate named Jeffrey Moore, who needed something to do while he was waiting to take the Nevada bar exam. Under the laws, as long as he was supervised by a licensed lawyer, Larry, he could practice at the same as an attorney. Elisa started him at $40,000 a year and gave him a brand new company car. So that's a really good deal.
Sure is.
She also put him up in his own hotel suite. So Elisa was free to stay in Las Vegas, as Moore would handle the day-to-day stuff in the Reno office. Moore would remember that Larry was a very moody guy. He could be very friendly, but he could also be very gruff, and he could be quite intimidating. As time progressed in his position and he got to know Elisa, Moore got this really weird vibe from her. She talked to him about her sex life with Larry, and then she'd behave seductively towards him. She made him nervous. So I kind of feel like maybe she hired him because she had the hots for him.
Maybe he was a backup.
Yeah. Now, once on a trip to Las Vegas, Elisa and a friend of hers invited Jeffrey Moore to get in the hot tub with them at their condo. Elisa's friend offered him a packet of brown powder also as a pick-me-up, and he was pretty sure that was methamphetamine. So what's better than a packet of meth? A new thriller to read?
Absolutely. Now, I just heard Laura Lippman has a new book coming out. I'm a huge fan of Laura Lippman, particularly her Tess Monahan series. So this is really exciting news. This new book, Sunburn, is a superb novel of psychological suspense about a pair of lovers with the best intentions but the worst of luck. Two people who are locked in a passionate yet uncompromising game of cat and mouse. However, instead of rules, this game has dark secrets, forbidden desires, inevitable betrayals, and cold-blooded murders. Jeez, that sounds like my kind of book.
Gillian Flynn, the author of Gone Girl, says, "Every time Laura Lippman comes out with a new book, I get chills. Sunburn is a dark, gleaming gem. Read it," she says. Advance reviews say these things about Sunburn: modern noir at its best, ingeniously constructed, and extremely suspenseful. Laura Lippman is a force to be reckoned with in crime fiction.
And so it's no wonder that this is a Bustle, Entertainment Weekly, and Pop Sugar most anticipated book of 2018.
Read Sunburn by Laura Lippman. You can find out more at lauralippman.net. Larry's Three Offices carried an overhead of about $100,000 per month. By the fall of 1995, Larry was having trouble paying his advertising costs. When the television people contacted him, he seemed surprised, though. He'd made good with the advertising people, but he realized he was overextended, so at this point he decided to close down the Las Vegas office and focus only on Reno. He decided to bring Elisa and her daughter Haley to live in his Reno house. So this meant that he kicked out his longtime girlfriend of 7 years and her children. Now, she was heartbroken, as you can imagine. When a friend asked Larry why he was leaving her, such a great woman, for Elisa, Larry's only explanation was, "Oh, I just get so bored." So he kind of knew his own problems. Yeah.
Now, in December of 1995, his Reno office accountant approached Jeffrey Moore to tell him that checks on the firm's trust account were bouncing. Now, this trust account money belonged to clients, and it's not supposed to be used for anything else.
Yeah.
This is a serious breach of ethics.
Absolutely.
So Jeffrey Moore looked into it and found that Elisa had been writing checks for unauthorized purchases on the trust account, and one large check, which was for the purchase of an American Quarter horse, had bounced. So Jeffrey was afraid to go to Larry himself, so he went to talk to a longtime friend of Larry named Pete Durney.
Well, according to Larry, he was shocked to hear what had been going on. He confronted Elisa in front of Pete. At first, she denied doing anything wrong, and then she became defensive and angry. But eventually, she broke down and she admitted to writing the checks. Then she took off in a temper and stayed with a friend for a few weeks. Now, looking back, it's possible that Larry knew about some of Elisa's behavior. He dealt with the situation by getting a loan from a Reno area developer and an old friend. Then he closed two accounts and opened new accounts with himself as the only authorized signer. He also hired an auditor to go over his books all the way back to July of that year.
So it sounds like he's taken the appropriate steps.
Yeah.
At least to begin with. But his interest is going to fade.
What do you mean?
Well, she comes up with a new scam that he's not aware of.
Oh.
And he should have been.
Right. But he's drinking and not really in on things, I guess.
Right.
Elisa was no longer allowed to work in Larry's office. People thought she was out of the picture totally. But then, shocking to just about everybody, on January 6th, 1996, Larry married her.
Amazing.
It was astounding to many people that Larry married a woman known as a thief and an embezzler. If Larry had just talked to Elisa's ex-husband, Kenneth Rattlesberger, he would have learned that Elisa had met him by going to work in his office, married him, then run off with a bunch of his money.
Sounds familiar, huh?
Very familiar. But there is some talk that maybe he did meet her ex-husband and went ahead anyway, which wouldn't surprise me either.
No.
He's a risk-taker. Employee Nancy Elkoff often had lunch with Larry and Elisa after that at a Reno seafood restaurant and bar near the office. Nancy was known for reciting lines from famous movies, and one of her favorite movies was Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. So there's a scene where Joan Crawford, who plays Blanche, a has-been movie star and alcoholic who's confined to a wheelchair, is tormented by her younger sister, Jane, played by Bette Davis. Blanche tells her sister, "You wouldn't be able to do these awful things to me if I weren't still in this chair." And Jane responds, "But chair, Blanche. Yeah, in that chair."
Oh, not the greatest New England accent, but passable.
Right. But Larry and Elisa would break into hysterics each time Nancy did it, because she did a lot better than I do, obviously. I've never seen the movie. From that time on, though, even on the day of Larry's death, the couple called each other Blanche. This was kind of an inside joke in reference to them both being in the chair of having damaging information on one another. So this made them both feel like there was no leaving the relationship. Pretty interesting dynamic.
Absolutely. Now, while Larry had said he was shocked by Elisa tapping into the trust account, it's quite possible he was lying about this.
I think so, yeah.
It's possible that he told her to tap into the account to pay his television advertising bills.
Yeah, but then she took things further and went and bought a horse.
Yeah, so at this point he has no choice after the checks bounce but to blame the entire thing on Elisa. Because otherwise he could lose his license to practice law.
And that's the only way they make money.
So the whole situation could eventually become mutual blackmail. Each partner in the marriage had something over the other.
So maybe that's why the horses were so appealing to him. If he didn't need to be a lawyer anymore, he could maybe get free.
Right.
Sometime in the summer of 1998, Larry's son Joe heard from a drunk Larry that he could never leave Elisa or she would ruin him. Joe believed that Elisa acted as an enthusiastic enabler whenever Larry went out on his drinking binges, because she made no efforts to keep him in line, but instead she seemed to enjoy it and take advantage of his absences. It didn't take long for Elisa to get back into the Reno office and take control either. She fired every employee who didn't display complete loyalty to her. Jeffrey Moore was one of them, and he took his concerns, finally, to the Nevada State Bar Association.
Yeah, when I'm reading this stuff, I'm wondering, why did it take him so long? Because this had been going on for quite some time.
Well, I think he was loyal to Larry, and then at one point they thought he'd gotten rid of her and things were going to be okay.
Yeah.
But then she came right back in, with a vengeance and fired people.
So the State Bar Association opened an investigation into Larry McNabney and Associates. His private audit had been completed on the accounts Elisa had used, and it showed a total of $74,000 that had been improperly taken from the client trust account.
It's a lot of money.
A lot of money. So Elisa was called in to testify, and she said that she knew it was wrong to transfer money from the accounts. Then to make up for it, she transferred $60,000 of Larry's personal money into the trust account. At the same time, she had expected a big case to come in, and she planned to put all the accounts back in order before anyone realized.
This is a story you hear over and over again. When people are embezzling, they think, oh, well, the next big thing's going to come and I'm going to pay it back.
Right.
I'm always
going
to
pay it back.
Right. And it just gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah. So the result of all this was that Elisa was legally barred from the office.
Finally.
And Larry was found guilty of 2 counts of unprofessional conduct. This embarrassed him greatly.
Yeah, he kind of went underground for a while. He was so embarrassed. He sold his Reno house and lost $43,000 on it. And then he and Elisa moved into rentals, so they really kind of were going down into a lower echelon.
Yeah.
Larry was really discouraged and was avoiding his old friends. I mean, failure wasn't something that he was comfortable with, obviously. In late 1998, Larry and Elisa moved to Sacramento, California to start all over. They opened a new law office, and they were editing and airing some of his old commercials and trying to start over from scratch, getting clients. The thing was, Elisa wasn't barred from the office in California, so she was able to work with Larry again, which is a disaster, and I don't know why he couldn't see that. But he seemed to have given up in many ways, and Elisa was just running things. She was running a law firm, even though she was a felon, and she wasn't even a lawyer or even a paralegal.
Yeah, so every day Elisa would go into the office, but Larry spent most of his days golfing and drinking. During a round of golf, he could consume a fifth of vodka. Wow.
Now, you're a golfer. How do you keep golfing when you're drinking that much?
Well, you have to have a tolerance for that.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you'd be carried out.
Yeah. Well, he did have a tolerance, I guess. It's kind of sad.
So clients would come in response to Larry's ads, but Elisa then would file a claim and close the deal with the insurance company. So he never had to do anything.
Not really. He was just the name behind everything.
Elisa's daughter Haley saw Larry as an abusive drunk, and she couldn't stand him. Elisa sent her to live with friends, and eventually Haley got her own apartment when she was just 15 years old.
That's not healthy, is it?
Good parenting, huh?
No. I guess sometimes she would hire people to watch her, which still doesn't seem great. That's not a very good mother. In 1999, Larry and Elisa met Greg Whalen, and this is when they developed an interest in showing American quarter horses. Greg and his daughter Debbie agreed to train Elisa's horse, the one she'd bought with the bad check. Then Larry bought a second horse. Elisa had convinced him that it was a good investment. But the care and training of the horse was not cheap, of course. It cost about $2,000 a month. Larry and Elisa began spending a lot of time hanging out around the Whalen ranch, and they became friends. On Greg Whalen's birthday, the McNabneys gave him a gold Rolex watch, so they were very generous. When Larry became interested in something, he really went all the way with it, so the horse showing business became his passion. The Whalens taught him how to show the horses. This appealed to Larry's need for the spotlight, and he began showing the gelding as an amateur exhibitor.
So meanwhile, there's no doubt that Larry was a chronic alcoholic, and it was kind of inevitable that he would be pulled over and arrested on a DUI. It's kind of strange that he hadn't been caught before in Reno or Las Vegas, but maybe his local fame had protected him.
I could see that. I mean, I think sometimes there's favoritism given to someone who's seen as famous or prominent.
Sure. Now, this time he was pulled over after a near rear-end collision. At the police station, he blew an alcohol level of 0.28. This is three, almost four times the legal limit, which is the equivalent of about 14 shots of alcohol in an hour. Now, people have died of alcohol poisoning at 0.34. So he was up there. I'm just amazed that he was able to get behind the wheel of a car at 0.28.
It's really scary, isn't it? I mean, he did have a high tolerance.
Well, you have to.
Yeah.
So afterwards, Larry was depressed and began to drink even more. He became verbally abusive of Elisa. Elisa insisted on paying off the driver Larry had nearly hit when the driver announced his intention to sue Larry. She gave the man a check for $35,000.
Now, this makes me wonder if maybe she hadn't paid the insurance bill and she was afraid of that, so she just paid the guy off.
Right.
Because that's a lot of money to just hand over for no reason if you have insurance.
Yeah, that's what insurance is for, right?
Right. So that's what I think.
That's a good thought.
Yeah. So Larry wasn't practicing much law, but his firm was still doing a lot of business. And the problem was, though, that the spent money exceeded the earned money. Because Elisa just spent like crazy. She purchased a new $60,000 truck and a new BMW, and she began bouncing checks to the Whalens, the horse trainers. To make up for some shortages, Elisa opened fraudulent credit cards in Greg Whalen's name. And then this is when Sarah Dutra entered the picture and things got a lot worse. Sarah was much younger than Elisa. She was born in 1980 to a stable Christian family in Vacaville, California. Sarah was one of the smartest kids in her classes. She was very pretty. She was voted class president in her senior year of high school, and she was an honor student and a member of the swim team. One dark spot in her family's life had been the arrest of her dad in 1995 for embezzling $140,000 from the Valley Evangelical Free Church. He agreed to repay the money and do 500 hours of community service, and he did avoid prison that way.
Yeah, he must have been embezzling for a while, though, to accumulate $140,000.
I would think so. Sarah started working at Larry McNabney & Associates in January 2000. She answered a newspaper ad for a receptionist. It was near Sacramento State University, and it paid quite well at $11 an hour. When summer came, Sarah was accepted as an art student at the Academy of Fine Arts in Florence, Italy. Elisa and Larry sent her off like they were her second set of parents. Three times over that next year, McNabney & Associates paid for Sarah to fly home from Italy to consult on creating a website for the firm. When Sarah returned to Italy, Elisa gave her a fur coat, a laptop computer, and a digital camera. All this was paid for by Larry McNabney & Associates. Elisa told her that they wanted to buy her a car because they were so proud of her. So that's kind of weird. Elisa bought a 1995 Saab for Sarah and made payments while she was still in Italy, and she said this was to help her establish her credit. But to buy the car, Elisa wrote a $2,000 check from the law firm's client trust account. So on one hand, she's telling her she needs to build good credit, but then she herself is doing fraudulent, illegal things.
Well.
Makes no sense.
Not at all.
No.
So when Sarah returned to work in Sacramento, she became kind of second in command to Elisa. Now, there's no evidence that Elisa's seduction of Sarah was sexual, but there's a possibility there.
Yeah, I think more than a possibility.
Even her daughter Haley was bothered by how close her mother was with Sarah and how much time they spent together. Elisa and Sarah are both signing Larry's name to checks, and the line between client money and Larry's money became ever more blurry. Elisa and Sarah spent many days shopping and eating at expensive restaurants.
Before she started working for the McNabneys, Sarah had a boyfriend, actually. His name was Jason Cataldo. After she returned from Italy, he said things changed. Sarah could never say no to Elisa, and he began to feel like he was second to her and kind of like their servant. Sarah became impatient with him, and she would sneer at people, especially people who had no money or who she didn't see as good looking. Then she began throwing around large amounts of money and told him, "You know, Jason, I was born to shop." So this wasn't the girl he'd fallen in love with.
Not the girl I'm in love with.
It's a big turnoff for him.
So Sarah's parents, Mark and Karen, didn't like Elisa at all. And they were certainly suspicious of her and wondered why she was hanging around with somebody who's 11 years her junior. Now, at the same time, Elisa had obvious contempt for Sarah's parents. Now, eventually, Jason was offended by how stuck up Sarah was acting, and he said he didn't want to see her anymore. And Sarah said that was fine with her.
That was over. But over time, Larry really began to dislike Sarah, too. He was obviously jealous of how much time she spent with his wife.
Right. And he told Greg Whalen he found them in bed together, Elisa and Sarah.
I know. So?
So there's your theory.
Well, in August 2001, Elisa and Sarah leased a house in a gated community near Lodi called Woodbridge. The house backed up to a golf course. Elisa paid the first month's rent and security deposit. But after that, the McNabneys were living almost completely on credit cards, and all the credit cards were near their maximum limits. So their whole financial standing is in the gutter.
Totally.
She's totally raped the whole fortune.
She's drained the swamp.
She has. By September 10th, 2001, they're pretty much broke. They've got $141 in their accounts. And the client trust account, even more disturbing, is down to $1,645. Plus, there are plenty of unpaid bills. So, how did this happen? There had to be something very unusual, because this just doesn't happen in normal life, that you have that much money and then you're like this.
Well, it does if you have someone draining it out of your accounts.
Yeah, but I mean, just how was it allowed to happen? I mean, Elisa had to have a real scheme to misinform Larry. And I think what she was doing was using fake check registers, so she had two sets of books.
She had two sets of books.
Which is really...
So. Because the one set was under Larry's supervision.
Well, as much as that went,
But he was the only one with authority on that account.
Right.
So that one looked good.
Right. But, well, another thing I think is that his heavy drinking, and there's reason to believe that his drinks were being spiked with ketamine by Sarah and Elisa, or at least by Elisa.
Yeah.
Which can make you lose your memory, so maybe he didn't remember what he was signing.
That could be.
Tell us a little bit about ketamine. I know it's like an animal drug.
Well, it was developed as a human drug for anesthesia because it gives you a deep anesthetic state and usually amnesia.
Okay.
Sounds ideal.
So if you're putting that in someone's drinks, that's serious.
It sure is.
Yeah.
I mean, it was eventually, it's primarily used as an anesthetic for horses now because there's better drugs to use in humans. But yeah, I can see... Where if you're abusing it, you're kind of asleep half the time and forgetful.
Right. So he could sign a check and then the next day he wouldn't even know he signed it.
Right.
So that could be one reason this happened. The McNabneys arrived at the horse competition on September 10th, and Larry seemed very confused and a bit out of it. He told friends he felt sick and he began staying in his hotel room. The next morning, friends would see a Do Not Disturb sign on his door. In his pickup, witnesses saw two spade shovels and a wheelchair. That's weird.
Yes, it is.
The next morning, Elisa said she and her husband had fought, and he left the show. This is when she said he's gone back to the cult. And then she starts giving away his stuff, offering his expensive ostrich skin boots to another horse trainer. She gave away a lot of his stuff. His golf clubs she gave to Greg Whalen, who said he was going to hang on to them because he thought Larry would come back for them.
Right.
She was wearing his diamond horseshoe ring and his Rolex watch. And then, even more suspiciously, she said, "Larry's never coming back. Believe me, where he is, he'll never want these again." So this is all very sudden and bizarre.
Very strange.
Yeah, I mean, Larry was one that he could have run off, but usually he didn't do things that suddenly. And why would he leave everything behind?
Well, and they had had dinner the night before, when other than being drunk and offensive, he seemed like the usual Larry. So in the weeks following Larry's disappearance, Elise had dyed her hair, lost 30 pounds, and leased a new Jaguar for herself and a BMW for Sarah. So the money's going out.
When detectives started asking about McNabney, Debbie Kale, Greg's daughter, told them about a conversation she'd had with Elisa before he disappeared. They were grooming horses in a barn when Elisa asked her, "Do you think that acepromazine could kill someone?" This was a horse tranquilizer. "Heck yeah," Debbie said. "It can tranquilize a 1,500-pound horse. Imagine what it would do to a human." Now, what we know is that Elisa gave Larry an overdose of a horse tranquilizer. She called Sarah to come back to the hotel to help her with Larry, and they removed Larry from the hotel in a rented wheelchair very early on September 11th. They drove off in Larry's truck, and they stopped in Yosemite. Sarah began to dig a grave there, but then they realized that Larry wasn't dead yet. Elisa and Sarah kept Larry's body in a refrigerator in their garage for 3 months after that.
Yeah, now that's just so grisly to me. I mean, so they drive out because they think he's dead.
Yeah.
And they're going to bury him, but he's not dead. So they load him back into the truck, back to the house or condo where they kill him, and then they stuff him in a fridge.
Well, the very sad part of this and the very gruesome nature of it is that they're having conversations with him on these drives to bury him.
Yeah.
He's asking for a drink of water. They're saying, "It's okay, Larry, we're going back home." That's incredibly sad and cruel.
And so for the next 3 months, Elisa kept Larry's office running, continuing to make excuses about his whereabouts to clients, to family members, and to friends. They forged Larry's name on documents. They misappropriated client funds. Elisa and Sarah spent thousands of dollars on new clothes, cars, and trips. They even called up Larry's son Joe one night and invited him over to party with them. Amazing. This was while Larry's body was in the fridge. Finally, an employee at the firm called the police and reported Larry as missing.
It took a while.
Took a long time, but he was never there anyway.
He wasn't, that's true, but it got really suspicious. His body had been moved to a nearby winery, where it wasn't discovered until February 5th, 2002. Larry had been buried in a hole 2 foot deep, and one of his legs was protruding from the soil. So I think the way they found this was there were vultures soaring overhead or something.
I think some birds of prey.
Maybe a smell. Yeah. So detectives were initially confused because the body wasn't more decomposed, because he'd been missing since September. But soon they did figure out that the body had been refrigerated for months. Bruising on his back would indicate that he had been put into the refrigerator while he was still alive. Otherwise, you don't bruise if you're already dead, right?
Right.
Right. Detective Javier Ramos took the name of the horse tranquilizer to a forensic pathologist who'd been unable to determine what had actually killed Larry. He found a significant amount of another horse tranquilizer, xylazine, in his system.
Yeah, so xylazine is a animal tranquilizer. It's used oftentimes in conjunction with ketamine when you're trying to do anesthetic and tranquilize the 1,500-pound animal. And it is a drug that humans can abuse, but there's a fairly narrow margin in terms of safety.
Well, I would imagine it's not something a person should even mess with.
No.
No. So days before her husband's body was unearthed in California, Elisa had pulled off the highway in Destin, a Florida panhandle town that was known for its beaches. Wearing her sexy lowrider jeans, she walked into a furniture store and greeted the owner. This was a 66-year-old man she'd met a few days earlier at a golf tournament in Mississippi. They'd had drinks, and she was at his side when he won $3,000 at a craps table. So he said he thought she was good luck, and he told her to stop by if she ever came through Destin. So this is what she did. He gave her a key to his condo overlooking the waters of the Gulf of Mexico, and she went and stayed there. So she must have charmed him.
Well, I guess she could do that, huh?
Yeah.
So after the discovery of Larry's body, Elisa was the subject of a nationwide manhunt. At this point, she was going by the alias Shane Ivoroni and was hiding out in Destin. On March 20th, 2002, Elisa was staying at her daughter Haley's friend's house in Fort Walton Beach when she was turned in for the reward money, so someone ratted her out. She was booked into the Hernando County Jail and was to be extradited. Now, while she's awaiting extradition, she gave a full confession to law enforcement. Then a week later, Easter Sunday 2002, she hanged herself in her jail cell.
Now, what about Sarah Dutra? She did go to trial for the murder of Larry. That was in 2003. She was facing life imprisonment without parole if convicted of first-degree murder. But then she was only found guilty of voluntary manslaughter.
Yeah, they couldn't agree on first-degree murder or even second-degree murder.
Surprising to me. She was sentenced to the maximum of only 11 years, and this is another case where I think being an attractive white woman, she was given preferential treatment. If this was a guy, especially a black man, or a poor person, a poor white person.
You're probably right.
You know, it's just, I don't know, I think she really got away with something here. I can kind of see how she was led astray by this older woman and heavily influenced. But when it gets to the point of this man being in the back seat, you know, just helpless.
Yeah, you're right.
That's terrible. That just shows evil to me. Mm-hmm. So what about Elisa's suicide note? That was something, huh?
That was. She asked her lawyer to sue the Hernando County Jail for not preventing her suicide.
So even at death, at the point of her death, she's still looking to get money out of
people. She's looking for the angles.
Jesus.
She also asked that her children receive any funds raised from this lawsuit. This is all I can give to my children. My actions now will allow them to move into the future without this heavy burden. They won't have to watch my trial on court TV. It should all die with me, she wrote in her note. She also claims that she is not checked regularly in her cell, but an investigation has since disputed that charge.
Right, because she was on suicide watch, which to me is a little weird. Why was she allowed to have the sheets?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they didn't take it seriously because she was such a manipulator. Sarah Dutra was released from the Central California Women's Facility on August 26th of 2011. So she served 85% of her sentence, which was just a little over 8 years, I guess?
Right.
What do you think about the length of that sentence?
Well, they went by the rules of the court. She was found guilty of voluntary manslaughter. The maximum that you can assign for that was 11 years.
I wonder why they didn't get her for anything, though, like, I don't know what they call it exactly, but getting rid of a body in a bad way. There's something for that.
Corpse abuse or something like that.
And what about all the fraud? I mean, many people go to prison for longer than that just for stealing money.
But she wasn't charged with that.
But why not?
I don't know.
She forged his signature.
I don't know.
She really got away with it because she was a young blonde.
Well, regardless, I mean, she was charged with first degree murder. They couldn't come to an agreement on that, nor second degree. They settled on the manslaughter.
I know. I'm just not real happy. I think she should have been punished longer. So there was a book on this called Cold Blooded. And there was also a made-for-TV movie called Lies My Mother Told Me, which was on Lifetime in 2005.
Interesting case.
Yeah. I didn't watch the movie because those Lifetime movies can be fun, but you can't trust anything.
Well, you don't know how factual.
Yeah. They're not helpful for research, but they can be fun to watch.
Right.
Right.
I'm interested, though, why Lauren committed suicide.
Because there was no way out.
Well, for her personality type, I figured she'd consider there's always a way out.
Yeah, I think she felt pretty much caught. I mean, there was so much as far as the fraud and the murder that she probably just thought that was it.
Well, whatever. She did confess.
Yep, right. And she never really planned anything anyway. She probably just spontaneously did that.
Right. And her lawsuit against the jail never came to any fruition.
No. So before we get into feedback, I am going to remind our listeners about Team Tiegrabber. Tiegrabber members are our primary support for our podcast, so I always like to bring it up. We recently released an episode about Robert Fisher, who's been on the run for 17 years and is believed to have killed his family before disappearing. I know you want to say something about that.
Well, the only thing I'd say is that I think he's dead.
Okay.
You think he's on the run?
Yes.
We'll see.
Yep. For more on that, you can join Tiegrabber and listen to the episode. So we consistently release a members-only episode at least once a month, and this is the perfect cure, wouldn't you agree, Doctor, for the dreaded hypoepisodemia, which is a lack of True Crime Brewery episodes to listen to.
Well, of course it is. I mean, the only way to combat this is to listen to more episodes.
So one out of one doctors here does recommend that.
100%.
Okay. So you can join for $3 or $5 a month on our website, tiegrabber.com. I did a revamping of the website this week, so it's a little bit different, but I think you'll find it easier to use.
It's still the same website. It just looks cooler.
Yes. It's new and improved.
Right.
Right. Our members also receive TCB gifts for joining, so that's fun. If you're interested, sign up at tiegrabber.com. Or you can support us on Patreon and hear the premium episodes there as a patron. We also have a second podcast I'd like to mention called Watching ID, where we watch a show on the Investigation Discovery Network, and then we talk about it. I hope to put out a new Watching ID episode by this week, too, to add to that collection. And those are free, of course, on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also support the podcasts if you'd like to make a purchase through our Shop the Brewery page on our website, or by giving us a positive review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen to the podcasts. The reviews help a lot in getting new listeners for the show. Another way to help with that is by word of mouth. So if you know someone who might enjoy our shows, please tell them about us. As you may know, CrimeCon is coming up May 4th through 6th in Nashville. We're going to have a table on Podcast Row for the first time, so we're really excited and a little bit nervous. I hope some of our listeners will come and keep us company there. If you use our promo code TCBrewery at the CrimeCon checkout, you can get 10% off admission. So if that's something that you can do, we'd love to see you there.
Yeah, and if you are there and you feel like going out for some beers, we're going to pick some good beer places to go.
That will be fun. So please write in and share your ideas and opinions with us for our feedback section on future episodes. You can also share your opinions and your experiences on our True Crime Brewery Fan Discussions page on Facebook. We have a lot of great listeners there who love to talk about true crime. So Dick, I'm going to let you start the feedback segment today.
Okay, I'm going to lead off with a note from Laura M. that's giving us an update on the Gregory Whitman murder from 1998. Now, this was something we discussed in another feedback.
Yeah, we haven't done an episode on it.
We haven't done an episode on this. This is a kid who was killed, as a 13-year-old, was killed by stabbing in 1998. And for the first time since this occurred, his brother Zachary is admitting guilt. "Yes, I can say I killed my brother by stabbing," he told the judge. Zachary entered into a plea deal that would have him eligible for parole in a year. So he was tried and convicted of the murder, and now he's admitted to it, and he's going to be up for parole in 2019. He pleaded guilty to third-degree murder in exchange for a sentence of 15 years, 230 days to 40 years. So this would make him eligible for a parole hearing, the earliest on January 3rd, 2019.
That's pretty soon.
Yeah. Well, this happened in 98.
So he's been in a while.
Right. So Gregory was killed after returning from school on October 2nd, 1998, and he apparently was attacked inside the front door, and his body was found in the laundry room. He'd been knifed more than 100 times and left nearly decapitated, and they arrested his 15-year-old brother for the murder and charged him as an adult. Ahead of his court appearance, Whitman met with prosecutors and described what happened. He said Zachary got mad at Greg because Greg was mad at him for hanging up on his girlfriend. Greg wouldn't drop the matter. Zachary grabbed a pair of soccer goalie gloves and a small penknife and went downstairs, but Greg followed and kept yelling at him. So Zachary said he only intended to scare his brother with a knife, but he ended up stabbing him. So Greg then ran to the back of the house. Zachary followed, continued stabbing him. Then he got scared and hid the knife and gloves under a tree in the backyard and called 911. So he's admitted to it, which I guess he did not do at the initial trial, and he's going to be eligible for parole in a year.
Yeah. Poor parents, huh?
Can you imagine going through that?
No.
You lose a kid, and your other kid is the one who did it. That's like a double whammy.
Yeah, right. It's terrible. Yeah, I think his father was talked to, and all he said is, please leave us alone.
Right, that's the recurring theme.
Yeah.
Please leave my family alone.
Yeah, they've been through enough. So I have a letter from Josephine B., and it's a case suggestion. And it's kind of funny. I've had this suggestion before, but I just recently bought a book called Simon Says about this case.
And what's that case?
The Dutcher Simon Sue murders. Isaac Grimes is serving a 60-year sentence for killing his one-time best friend, Tony Dutcher, when he was only 15. Grimes pleaded guilty to second-degree murder, but the most shocking part was his explanation of why he did it. According to him, it amounted to a twisted version of the children's game Simon Says. This began in the fall of 1999, when Grimes entered his freshman year at Palmer High School in Colorado Springs. That is Joe Kenda territory.
It is.
Wonder if Joe was still working in 99. He might have been.
Almost 20 years ago, he could have been.
So he was a lonely boy, and he admits he wasn't popular. But early that year, he crossed paths with a charismatic high school senior named Simon Sue, shared an interest in chess and video games. And with that, the upperclassman took the younger, nerdy boy under his wing. Grimes said Sue even offered him a chance to join his club called OARA, or the Operations and Reconnaissance Agents. It would be the turning point of Isaac's life. For a young boy desperate to have connections with others, hanging out with Simon Sue and being invited to join this club was everything he desired. Grimes said he finally felt like he was part of a band of brothers. Simon assured him that the group of boys, which included fellow high schoolers John Matheny and Glenn Urban, would look out for one another. So Grimes and his so-called band of brothers would quickly move on from fun, harmless activities like chess to more dangerous ones. Grimes claims that Simon took the boys to a local range to practice shooting weapons, and he taught them how to disassemble and clean the firearms. The group was organized in a paramilitary structure with Simon in command. He said he started out as a lieutenant, and then he became a major, and then a lieutenant colonel. So there's a lot of fantasy involved in this whole situation.
Yeah, it sounds like.
Yeah. Now, Grimes says he was forced to eat and drink until he vomited, and then he had to repeatedly watch Faces of Death, a notorious cult film featuring gruesome footage of animals and people being killed. This was all part of Sue's master plan. I think that it desensitized me to violence, Grimes said. I had been trained into obedience like a dog. Going against him would be like going against living, basically. All of this was supposed to be part of their training in preparation for their larger mission, to be prepared to fend off a coup in Simon Sue's family's native land, the small South American country of Guyana. Coincidentally, this tiny country is best known to Americans for another cult tragedy, the mass murder-suicide of People's Temple leader Jim Jones and an astounding 918 followers. Now, unlike this dubious geopolitical scheme, Grimes' motivation was simple and personal. His goal was to have friends and be part of something bigger. He claims that he missed possible warning signs, partly because he was under tremendous peer pressure, and he maintained that he believed Simon Sue had brainwashed him. Grimes said he was ordered to do many things he didn't want to do, including burglary, but was convinced if he didn't follow orders, he and his family would be killed. He not only believed that Simon Sue would take action against him and his loved ones, but that the OARA was a global organization that infiltrated into local law enforcement. Grimes claimed that Sue had him make copies of the keys to his house and provide him with pictures of his entire family so he could identify them. He said he lived in constant fear. He was convinced there was no escape, no way to tell his parents, no place where he could run for protection. So when Simon Sue ordered Grimes to prove his loyalty by not just committing murder, but by killing his former best friend, Tony Dutcher, and his family, the younger boy agreed. In this case, Simon says, was not a game, obviously. On New Year's Eve 2000, Grimes viciously sliced Dutcher's throat, nearly decapitating him in the process. Tony Dutcher's grandparents, Joanne and Carl Dutcher, were also found shot to death in the home.
Whoa. He did that too?
Well, I don't know if it was him or the other kids. Doesn't say. I guess that's to be continued. I haven't read the book yet.
We'll have to look into that.
Yeah, that was just a synopsis of the case. But I do have the book to read, so if the book has additional information, I think it's probably plenty that would fill an episode. And I also would like to really get your opinions on what you think of the peer pressure involved and that kind of decision-making in a teenager.
Oh, sure. Because we both know that peer pressure plays a big role in life as a teen.
Absolutely. I mean, you're so easily influenced. It's scary, really.
It is. So I have one from Crazy Krista about our episode, The Unfortunate Sons. Hello, Dick and Jill. I watched that Netflix show, Confession Tapes. That show is fantastic and shocking. I'm with Dick on this particular case. I'm almost completely sure that these two guys are innocent. There just is not sufficient evidence that Sebastian and Atif carried out these horrendous crimes. See, I always like it when people agree with me.
And most people didn't, but I did pick out a couple that did. We have a few.
You're flattering me. Yeah, most people said we were full of shit.
Most people were really sure that they were guilty and thought that we were easily influenced by the documentary and the confessions tape show.
Well, okay.
Which you never know. We may have been influenced. I personally am not sure that they're innocent, but I feel that their trial was unfair. You believe they're totally innocent.
You're trying to straddle the line.
I'm just, yeah, I guess.
Because I think they're innocent and that the evidence was not presented that would allow them to show their innocence.
Yeah, I agree with the whole court thing, yeah.
Okay. Then Crazy Krista, I like this name,
yeah,
goes on to suggest a case. She has a case called Baby Kate from Ludington, Michigan. Ludington?
I think it's Ludington.
Well, you're supposed to know. You're a Michigan person.
I don't know every town.
You should. So this is a little baby that went missing in June of 2011 when she was 4 months old. Neither she nor her body has ever been found. Her father's in prison after being convicted first of unlawful imprisonment and then of murder. Something is off with this entire story, and I'm actually shocked that the mother of the child was never charged. So as a lifelong resident of Michigan, I would love for you to cover a Michigan crime. I think we could do that. Let's look into it.
Okay. Sounds good. So I have another one on unfortunate sons. This is from friend of the show, Alana. The Mr. Big operation is still here in Canada, she says, with stricter perimeters. Realize not in U.S. and many don't like it. Also realize some things are questionable. Some suspects exonerated. Each case is reviewed before trial and some thrown out and no trial. Some cases overturned due to false confessions. There are some cases where it did work well. The daughter whose mother disappeared found out her father, a gambler and a drinker, killed her mother many years before. A Mr. Big setup got him to reveal where he dumped her body. Erin Chorney, 18, disappeared after trying to break off with her emotionally and physically abusive boyfriend, Michael Bridges. She was only found after the sting setup that he took them to where he buried her in the cemetery. There were many others, like so much in life that can be harnessed for good or abused. The no-blood issue with Burns and Raffae isn't signaling their innocence. More offenders today have figured out ways to avoid blood evidence. A recent case is Chris Porco, who drove from High University to his parents' home at 2 a.m. and bludgeoned them both with an axe. Father died. The mother barely survived with serious disfigurement. Not a drop of blood on him or in his vehicle. I see Burns as a golden child, probably Raffae too. I suspect your strong dislike of Mr. Big colored your research. Can happen to all of us as humans. T.C. Chamberlain, geologist, wrote a paper on multiple hypotheses. His main point, if we elevate a working hypothesis to a ruling theory too prematurely, the mind is so constituted it will only consider evidence supporting the theory and ignore any evidence to the contrary. Don't like the Mr. Big sting, so therefore anything arising from it is dubious. Still see Burns lounging on a couch, casually and coolly describing the murders. And that's the thing, all these things can trigger your emotions and your opinions on the case. Either way, I agree with that.
I would too. But the other part of that is, does the end justify the means?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think to a lot of people it does. If you're catching someone who did a murder, it doesn't really matter how you do it in many people's opinions.
Right.
But then to others of us, that's frightening because that means all of us are at risk of being falsely convicted.
I think so. That's my problem.
Yeah. But definitely, I think that this episode, we got so many opinions and so much to think about. It was a great episode to do. I like an episode with a little controversy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we certainly hit a nerve with that one, didn't we?
We did, yeah.
Because I have another one on unfortunate sons.
Okay.
This is from Andrea M. So just listen to the Raffae Case podcast. While I agree that the evidence of the Mr. Big sting was dodgy, they are clearly guilty in my opinion. Sebastian is a stone-cold psychopath. Easy to see where he gets it from when you hear his father.
See, that's funny, because I thought his father was charming. I liked him. So it's just all your opinion. Yeah.
But that's how Andrea saw it.
Yeah, I know.
She says that when you hear the father's interview, you know. And Atif was under Sebastian's spell.
Could be.
Do you know any Muslims? I have several in my family. No way would Atif not know or care to find out about an Islamic funeral for observant parents.
So I will take that to heart because we don't really have any Muslims that are close to us in our lives. So I don't really know how common it would be to know that. Do you?
Well, I think you have to know it. But as we said, maybe in the stress of things with the murder investigation, he didn't think it was going to happen when it actually happened.
That's true. I could see after a murder, you might think that these rules are not going to be followed.
I'm pretty sure he would have been aware of the custom.
Sure. But as to would he expect the custom to be followed, we're not sure.
I'm not.
Okay.
So, and then the final thing is that we left out how Sebastian had used a similar false alibi ruse for a previous fraud.
Yeah, we missed that.
It's new to me.
Mm-hmm.
This motive was financial, and that's why Atif's sister had to die, so they could get all the parents' assets, not just the insurance. The house alone was worth $100,000.
Just to me, someone who's going to Cornell and has a future like that, I mean, $100,000 is going to be fun for a while, but it's not going to make your life better.
2 years' tuition.
Yeah, really. Really.
This is all my opinion, of course, but the behavior of Sebastian is 100% consistent with psychopathy to this day.
And I totally respect everyone's opinion.
Well, we like the opinions.
Absolutely.
And we like being able to argue, or maybe not argue, but just make our own statements.
And as much as I enjoy hearing from people who agree with me, of course, it's almost more fun to hear from people who disagree because then it gives you more to think about and talk about, and it really spurs more of a conversation, which I really enjoy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that one, as we said, that one's engendered a ton of discussion. I'm sure we're not done yet.
No, and these are, of course, just the kind ones. We got some nasty letters that we won't read.
Oh, well, we should do that.
Nah.
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 All right.
People that just kind of lost their temper. And I don't want to read that kind of stuff. I want to have healthy conversation with people.
Well, yeah, we want a reasonable discussion.
Yeah.
Not a tirade.
No, that's not helpful.
Okay.
Okay, so I just have one more comment, and this is on the Andrea Yates postpartum psychosis episode we did quite a while back.
A long time.
Yeah, it's just a comment from Jennifer, which I found really just poignant, so I just wanted to read it. She says, my brother-in-law's a firefighter. Every couple of years, he responds to a call for a mom with postpartum psychosis. The mom ends up trying to harm the baby, and sometimes herself. The last time was a mom who slit both her throat and her baby's. They both ended up living, thank goodness.
Well, you know, there's a fairly high incidence of postpartum baby blues, and there's a less of an incidence of depression, actual depression postpartum. And there's a tiny incidence of true psychosis, but it does occur.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that uncommon.
So this is something you really need to look out for in your line of work, because you're seeing moms with their new babies all the time.
Oh, yeah. When we screen at the newborn visit, the 1 month, 2 month, 4 month, and 6 month visits, all those times we're screening for signs of illness in the mom.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing is, if the mom doesn't want help, it really doesn't seem like there's a lot you can do. That's what worries me.
That's true. And the other thing is that they have to answer, obviously, the questions honestly.
So in that way, I think it might be important to talk to the husband or partner.
Well, yeah, that would be. But we don't get to do that often.
No.
Maybe the first or second visit, mm-hmm. both parents will come. But usually after that, it's just one parent, and that's typically the mother.
Mm-hmm. Of course, with the case of Andrea Yates, there was all kinds of warning signs. She'd been hospitalized. She'd made threats.
Oh, yeah. Well, Andrea Yates is a special circumstance. There's a ton of stuff going on with her that was known.
Yeah, and I feel like her family really let her down and, of course, let the children down because she never should have been left alone with those children for even a minute.
No.
No. She shouldn't have even had all those children. She was in no condition to do it.
Well, she shouldn't have had that many children.
That's what I mean. I'm not saying she couldn't have had one. I'm just saying after one or two and she's having these symptoms, probably wasn't a good idea. Her doctor recommended maybe she shouldn't be getting pregnant right away.
It probably was a reasonable suggestion to not have any more children.
Yes, because all those children died, which is horrible. Okay, I know you have one more, and then we'll wrap it up for the day.
I have one more. This is from Anne. Another case suggestion. Please consider Jody Arias and Dahlia DiPolito. I'd like to hear your thoughts on these two women. Well, Anne, we have done Jody.
Yes.
So you can find her on our website someplace.
Yes, she's on our podcast feed and on our website. The name of the episode was Fatal Exposure.
Now, Dahlia DiPolito, this is an interesting story. On August 2009, former madam Dahlia DiPolito conspired with a hitman to arrange her ex-con husband's murder. Well, this sounds like a marriage made in heaven, huh? A former madam and an ex-con?
This was an excellent episode on either Dateline or 48 Hours.
So days later, it seemed as if all had gone according to plan. The beautiful young Dahlia came home from her health club to an elaborate crime scene, complete with yellow tape outlining her townhome and police milling about. When Sergeant Frank Ranzi of the Boynton Beach, Florida police informed her of her husband Michael's apparent murder, the newlywed DiPolito could be seen on surveillance video collapsing into the cop's arms. Yeah, we've seen this.
Yeah. Great footage.
Like any loving wife would, or any wife who is actually pretending to be loving would.
Yeah.
The only thing missing from her performance were actual tears, and the only thing missing from the murder scene was an actual murder. This was an elaborate sting.
That was great, yeah.
So Dahlia had several lovers, and one of them tipped off the undercover detective who posed as a hitman, and he met with Dahlia to plot her husband's murder. While his team planned, then staged the murder scenario, brazenly inviting the reality TV show Cops along for the ride. Cops' video went viral, sparking a media frenzy. Twisted tales of illicit drugs, secret boyfriends, sex for hire, a cuckolded former con man, and the defense's ludicrous claim that the entire hit had been staged by the intended victim for reality TV fame.
Yeah, that was crazy.
So in Poison Candy, case prosecutor Elizabeth Parker teams with best-selling crime writer Mark Ebner. They take you behind and beyond the courtroom scenes with astonishing never-before-revealed facts, whipsaw plot twists, and exclusive photos and details far too lurid for the trial. We get to see those?
If you want.
And it led to 20 years in jail for Dahlia.
But I love the way they caught her. That was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, really good. Okay, Dick, I think that wraps it up.
Okay. Let's hang around the quiet end for a while, see if anyone wants to have a beer with us.
Okay.
And head for home.
All right, sounds good.
Okay.
All right, we will see you at the quiet end.
Bye, guys.
Bye, everybody.